Well, two new studies bolster the popular theory that the moon formed from debris after a rogue planet smacked into Earth about 4.5 billion years ago. One fresh line of evidence for the so-called Big Smack comes from the oldest record of Earth's ocean's tides ever found. 3.2 billion-year-old rocks from South Africa. The layers reveal that the moon's orbit was clearly circular, as it is today, consistent with the giant impact theory, says a Virginia Tech geologist, Ken Erickson, who led the study in the issue of Journal Geology. If the moon formed elsewhere, then was captured intact by Earth's gravity, the moon's orbit would have been extremely elliptical, and tidal rock layers would not have shown such normal cycles. In the second study, German geochemists determined Earth and moon each separated into a core, mantle, and crust 50 to 100 million years after the solar system formed some 4.56 billion years ago. And then there's another theory that maybe the moon is artificial. It seems impossible, doesn't it? In a moment, Who Built the Moon with our guests Christopher Knight and Alan Butler on Coast to Coast AM. And welcome to Coast to Coast. Now, Christopher Knight divides his time between marketing consultancy and historical research. He has written four books to date, co-authored with Robert Lomas. He has invested 7 years conducting research into the origins of Freemasonic rituals. His interest in Freemasonry began in 1976 when he joined a local lodge simply to find out what these men did behind their closed doors. Over the next couple of years, he realized that no one understood what the rituals were about or where they had come. Over a quarter of a century later, he has tracked the origins of these rituals down to prehistoric stonemasons in the British Isles. Christopher was our guest about a year ago on Coast to Coast AM. Christopher, how are you? And thanks for joining us tonight.
It's a pleasure to be back. Hi there, George.
Indeed. And Alan Butler has a special interest in ancient civilizations and history. His work has been geared towards uncovering mysteries from the past. An expert in astrology and astronomy, Alan has worked hard over the years to gain an understanding of the great importance of ancient civilizations and what they put upon the stars and planets, both in a practical and mythological sense. First-time guest on Coast to Coast. Alan, hello to you.
Hello, George. Nice to be with you.
Both of you, indeed. Fascinating subject matter. I'll start with you, Christopher. How did you get involved in this one? Who built the moon?
Well, strangely enough, it is directly connected to my original research. Once I started looking at the origins of Freemasonic ritual, which I expected to be a few hundred years old, the chain of the linkage of information just keeps going back. And we got, as you just mentioned, back to the Stone Age period even. And then working forward from that, certain problems, we say, sprang up that needed to be resolved. So Alan and myself started to look at these problems, and that took us towards the moon, which was wholly unexpected. We didn't sort of wake up one morning and think, hey, I wondered if the moon's artificial. But the research took us there, and once we started looking at it, we found that lots of people were saying the same thing. Scientists were saying the same things. But we had completely different information to bring to the debate. And by the time we'd correlated, spent a couple of years correlating all the information we got, there was one big picture. So strangely enough, it's all part of the same research.
I heard, and we'll talk about this later on, that there was an experiment done when we landed on the moon, in that it had a pinging sound to it, almost like it was hollow and sounded metallic, but we'll talk about that in a moment. The two theories that I talked about before you both came on, of course, one was that a huge object smacked into the Earth and helped form the moon, and then the other was that the moon and the Earth simply separated into a core, mantle, crust 50 to 100 million years after the solar system formed. Let's talk about those two possible theories first of all. Alan, your theory aside, of these two, which one would you think would be the most plausible?
Well, each has its own particular problems. The most widely accepted one among scientists at the moment is the one where the Earth was hit by a large object, planetary-sized object, soon after the formation of the solar system. This is known as the Big Whack theory. We looked at this extremely closely because it is the one that's accepted most now. The separation theory is less accepted. But it has its great problems. in order for this model to have worked, this extremely large body hit the Earth, the two planetary bodies coalesced, and then came apart again, and the residue that was left formed into the Moon. The only problem is that computer models show that if this had happened, which is an extremely unlikely event in the first place, sometime later, another impact was necessary, which was called Big Whack 2, coming from the opposite direction in order to slow down the Earth enough, because it would have been spinning so rapidly, it would still have been spinning much faster than it is at the moment. In fact, the more you look at either theory, the more you realise that they're not at all plausible. The only reason that they're used is because they're the only answers available. We know, for example, that the Moon was not a captured asteroid, for the evidence that you've already outlined yourself. And none of the other theories from history stand up at all. So it only really leaves us with those two theories, and particularly with the Big Whack theory. But when you really look at it, it's so incredibly implausible that to suggest that the Moon is artificial is less implausible.
Okay, you two started putting together this theory, and there are some others out there who believe that the Moon is artificial. What does that say, though, about all the other moons around all the other planets in the solar system? Surely they can't be artificial, are they?
No. In fact, we're quite prepared to accept that every satellite in the solar system, apart from the Moon, is quite natural. There's nothing unusual about moons forming, but if you look at the general size and shape of moons in the solar system, they bear a strong relationship to the size of their host planet. Mars is very close to us, which also has satellites. It has two. But they're extremely small, very rocky, and quite clearly are captured asteroids and are not part of the body of the planet itself. Our moon is very different. We know for sure that the material that makes the moon was once part of the Earth. We don't deny that. But it was only a part of the Earth. If you take the relative sizes of the Earth and the Moon is massive. It only takes 3.66 moons to make the size of the Earth. And the Moon is very, very light in weight. In other words, it has very little mass. So although we know for sure that it's part of the Earth, it's only a very selective part of the Earth. It's material that comes from very close to the surface. One would normally expect, with either of the theories that we mentioned, or with a captured asteroid, that you would get different findings. It's a very anomalous body.
Well, let's talk about the size, mass again, and also these orbital characteristics of the Moon as well. You are right. It is huge compared to other moons in relationship to their planet. It might include part of this large object that smashed into us. Maybe it does, maybe it doesn't. Why is it unusual, though, in terms of the size and the mass? It is so big, but like you say, so light. Why is that unusual?
First of all, we've got to say that there is no evidence whatsoever for the planetary impactor. When something forms in a certain part of space, it develops a very specific chemical signature. Now, the Earth and the Moon share that chemical signature, but there is no signature of any other item that came in. So the proponents of the theory for the Big Whack cannot explain what happened to the planetary impactor. It certainly didn't become part of the mass because its signature is not there.
What about its orbit? Anything unusual here?
Its orbit has changed quite significantly. It's quite obvious, everybody knows, that the Moon is getting further and further from the Earth all the time. It's its orbit at this moment in time that particularly interests us, about 4.5 billion years after it was formed, because of the position of the Moon relative to the Earth and the Sun, we get total eclipses. An eclipse happens when the face of the Moon passes the face of the Sun. Now, there's nothing strange about the fact that the eclipse happens. What's really odd is that it's so perfect, because every so often, the match as the Moon passes across the face of the Sun gives us a total eclipse. And it's not approximate, it's absolute. We say that according to chance, this simply shouldn't happen.
One of our past guests, Christopher and Alan, suggested that the Moon was towed into orbit. What's your take on that? You first, Christopher.
don't think it was towed into orbit. I think it was created in its present position. Just to say, science fully understands that the strangest object in the whole known universe is our moon. It's our nearest neighbour, but it's the strangest thing. I mean, Erwin Shapiro from the Harvard Smithsonian Center for Astrophysics said the best explanation for the moon is observational error. The moon doesn't exist. You know, there's big problems with this object, and it doesn't fit any normal explanation whatsoever. Our view is that it was made from materials taken from the surface, the tiny skim surface of the Earth, not from any large amount of the Earth, such as you would expect if it was hit by an object. So a tiny skim was just sort of peeled off the surface of the Earth in some way, and we think it was formed in its original orbital position from this very light material that is on the surface of the Earth. So how that was done is, we debate that in the book, but there is no natural way it can exist, and the number of astrophysicists that accept that there is no explanation is very long indeed.
So you think the material, the makeup of the moon, that itself is not artificial?
No, the moon is made out of the surface material of the Earth. There is no doubt about that, zero doubt about that. But it doesn't have the heavy materials that the Earth has got, because obviously with the Earth, the heavy materials tend to sink towards the core, and we have different layers as it comes outwards. The outer layer of the Earth, the real skim surface, is what the moon is made of. I mean, the Pacific Basin, for instance, that is what largely where the moon came from.
All right, how could it have been manufactured, though? I mean, in essence, are you saying that there was nothing there prior to, or did they have something to sculpture and work with?
There was nothing there at all, and the Earth was, well, it was very young, but it was just a desolate ball of matter hurtling about. We're jumping the gun here, sort of, because the evidence that it is artificial is considerable, and it's only once you have to accept that you start to then consider, well, how can it exist? And then you've got to think about candidates. So half of our book, or more than half of the book, discusses the evidence as to why the moon cannot be natural, and the last section deals with who did it, sort of detective work, and we can only think of three culprits, shall we say, for manufacturing the moon 4.6 billion years ago. And the technique could vary slightly dependent on which of those three it was. But the fact remains that the only rational, sensible argument is that it was done artificially. And lots of scientists have said this before. We're not the first by any means. But we now know that whoever engineered it deliberately put a message in there, a very, very clear message to say, look what I've done. Pay attention. You need to know this.
In terms of what the moon does for this planet, let's talk a little bit about that if we can, you two. What are the benefits? The moon is where it is, and because it is, it's done some things for our planet. Let's talk about some of those. Alan?
There are a massive amount of things that the moon has done for our planet. Let's talk first of all about plate tectonics. This sounds a bit complicated, but it's what gives us a lot of our mountain ranges and also what leaves us susceptible to earthquakes. The surface of the Earth is composed of plates of material, which are, if you like, floating on the underlying magma. These plates are massive, and they sometimes meet each other, and they've traversed the globe. Now, although it seems very inconvenient to us to have plate tectonics because of the earthquakes, at the same time, it's extremely important because it also produces volcanoes. Now, life demands certain prerequisites, and amongst these are the very minerals and the chemical building blocks upon which life is built. And without plate tectonics, life would therefore not happen. We would be in a very barren situation, like, for example, on Mars or on Venus, which have solid surfaces. The moon being so massive, first of all, prevented the planet from becoming solid in the first place, and also because it was so close to the Earth at first and had a much lower orbit than it has now, it created huge tides every time it passed over, and that's what sparked off plate tectonics, and without those, then we most certainly wouldn't be here. Also, the Earth is a very unstable planetary body because of the nature of its core. And no scientist disagrees that, left to its own devices, the Earth would keep toppling over, literally. And the position of the moon and the very specific orbit that it occupies is what keeps the Earth upright on its orbit. And in addition to that, we need a very stable sort of seasonal element if life is going to develop on the Earth. If the Earth did not have the specific angle it has relative to the sun, then we would end up with a situation whereby the equators would boil lead and the north and south pole would be unbelievably cold. Mm-hmm. And there would be little or no temperate zone, and it's the temperate zones that really are the places where life formed and flourished. And once again, the moon is primarily responsible for the fact that the Earth has the orbit that it has.
If the moon was manufactured, how did they take this layer from the Earth and form it and shape it to form this massive structure called the moon?
The most likely explanation for that, that we can see within our known understanding of physics, is that they probably used black hole technology. We're getting very close now to being able to create black holes. In fact, in only a few months, we will be in laboratory conditions, in cyclotrons, creating extremely small black holes. Once you know how to use a black hole, which is a device that has tremendous potential in terms of its gravitational pull, then you could string a whole series of shielded black holes around the infant Earth. These would be able to draw matter from the surface of the Earth, which would form a stream at the desired orbit around the black holes, and ultimately the black holes would be turned off, and this stream of matter would eventually coalesce, after millions of years, of course, to become a viable satellite.
There is evidence for that, George.
That could have been used.
There is evidence for that.
Is there?
No. It's one of the strangest things about the moon is that, as Carl Sagan said, you cannot have a natural planetary object that is hollow. And the moon appears to be either hollow or have virtually no core. What it has got are areas called mascons, which are areas of mass concentrations around the surface of the moon. So instead of created around a single core like every other body that we know of, it's got these mascons under its surface distributed in different areas, as though each was attracting material to it, and the closer they got to it, the denser the material. And the early moonshots from both the Soviets and from American spacecraft crashed into the moon because they assumed it was like every other object, and they calculated their landing on the basis of an object that got denser towards the center. Even now, when a vehicle flies across the surface of the moon, it goes up and down as it goes because of these areas of strange concentration of mass, which is entirely in accordance with the idea that a series of centers, such as miniature black holes, was used to create the moon. There is no explanation for these mascons at all.
What about the possibility that the moon is a huge spacecraft? Is that far-fetched?
That's nonsense. Absolute nonsense. It is a spacecraft because it is flying in space, but it is not alien. There is no doubt whatsoever. Scientifically, it's impossible for it to come from anywhere else. It is part of the Earth and was manufactured from materials taken from the Earth. Although it doesn't obey any of the rules of a natural space object, we know what it's made of.
When we come back, let's find out when you think this was manufactured. Lots more to talk about right here on Coast to Coast AM. I'm George Norrie. And welcome back to Coast, Christopher Knight, Alan Butler, our guest, their book, their work called Who Built the Moon? They have two respective websites. They're linked up at coasttocoastam.com right now. Alan, Christopher, when do you believe the moon was manufactured? If our solar system is 4.56 billion years old and Earth is right around 4.5 billion years old, when do you think the moon was formed?
Well, we think the moon came into existence, was actually created probably very shortly after the Earth first coalesced, so sometime very early in the solar system's history. There's absolutely no doubt about that because of the chemical composition of the moon and because of its oxygen isotope fingerprint. It was created shortly after the Earth coalesced.
Isn't it possible, though, just possible, that if it was made, manufactured, that it could have been maybe a mere 100 million years ago? Possible?
Impossible.
Impossible.
Impossible. All of science has got it so wrong. Everything we know about dating techniques would have to be wrong for that to happen. When the first rock was brought back from the moon, from the Apollo missions, it was found to be this random rock picked up with the same age as the oldest known rock on Earth. There is no doubt it is very ancient. And there are some strange claims from people that say the moon came into existence within human memory and so forth. It didn't. It was created way back 4.5 billion years ago as an incubator to create life on Earth, because without that moon being exactly where it was then and where it is now and doing exactly what it's done, there would be no higher life on Earth at all, and probably no life at all, not even an amoeba. So it was created as an incubator to create life on Earth, and if it hadn't been there, we wouldn't be here either.
Well, that's true. How thick do you think the moon is?
Thick. It's very sponge-like. It's not dense. It goes all the way through, possibly with a hollow center or an extremely light center, but it has no heavy metals in it whatsoever. That's how it's known that it's taken from the surface of the Earth, where there are very few heavy materials because they've sunk to the center of the Earth. So it's this extreme, for its given size, it's extremely light.
It's almost like a shield, isn't it, in some form and fashion?
It doesn't provide any protection to the Earth in terms of incoming objects, for instance. It's its gravitational effect on the Earth that is extremely important and isn't fully understood. I mean, the way we came into studying the moon was from our own interests in ancient systems of measuring based on the pendulum. And it's known, for instance, when there is when the sun's light is blocked out by the moon passing in front of it, because the moon is 1/400th the size of the sun, but it's exactly 1/400th of the distance between the two. So when we get them aligned, pendulums go crazy, and no one understands that. So there's something happening between the Earth, the sun, and the moon that is not understood. That is extremely significant, and appears to affect animals and certainly affects pendulums. So there are elements clearly we do not understand yet, but what we do understand is that no moon, no humans.
There's no question that during the full moon, and I've talked to a number of people who work in the emergency medical field and police officers, during a full moon, people act weird, strange, by and large. They have the incidence of crime goes up, shootings. It's very, very strange. Why is that? There's got to be some connection here with the moon, with the full moon.
That's probably not entirely surprising. The human brain is made up of a very, very large percentage of water. We only have to observe the ocean every time the moon passes overhead and watch the way the tides happen on the Earth to understand that it has a tremendous gravitational effect. Now, it's quite likely that a full moon, when the moon is right overhead, this effect is greater and has a biochemical effect on the brains of both humans and animals. A lot of studies have shown that you cannot actually measure this in any calculable sense, although my experience tells me that you're right and that there is an effect caused by the full moon. But it's almost certainly quite a normal effect, because it's distorting brain matter and other biochemical matter.
It does. If it pulls tides, if it creates tides, why wouldn't it do the same on a smaller scale with people's circulation and everything else that's in their brain?
Absolutely. You can actually measure the tides, the moon's tides, in a cup of tea. That being the case, and bearing in mind that we're over 80% water, it would be very strange if it didn't have a bearing on us.
I agree.
We know that it does. I mean, experimentation have been done on shellfish, for instance, where they've been moved inland in the U.S. and put in completely sealed tanks, and they respond to phases of the moon when they've got no clues from their environment. So there is something directly coming from the moon that they are picking up, rather than from the actual tidal movement of the sea or anything else. So whilst we don't fully understand it, there is little doubt that the moon does affect us. And of course, as you said, there are quite a number of studies that have been carried out. Some have been inconclusive, but others have shown that violence and general aggression can increase during full moons. There may not be a direct linkage, but there is certainly a statistical comparison that says something strange happens when there is a full moon.
The fact that the moon is so immense as opposed to a bit smaller object, which if it were smaller, it might be easier to accept this theory of both of yours. But the fact that it is larger, should that be a reason why people would say this is impossible?
That's the reason why it has to be so, because the moon should not be as it is. If it wasn't, I mean, we started out not by having strange ideas about the moon. We started out with the mathematics of the moon because that's the direction we came from measuring systems. And the moon is built using two systems of measurement, the metric system and the ancient megalithic yard. But principally, it's if you took an automobile apart in a 1,000 years' time, you'll be able to deduce that it was built to the metric system because every part is engineered to it. So you'd soon deduce meters and millimeters. And the moon is the same. We can deduce exactly the blueprint of how it was built. And there is no doubt about it. All the numbers are very clear. This was built to a mathematical blueprint using the metric system.
The specifications are important in this particular case, aren't they?
Absolutely central. I mean, we wouldn't have believed a few years ago that we would have written a book with the title Who Built the Moon. You know, it sounds ridiculous, but people will decide what they want to believe or not want to believe on past prejudices. If you actually look at facts, we've had to come kicking and screaming to accept that the moon cannot be natural, and that, in fact, whoever built it has deliberately left the message to say, look what I've done. When you look at the evidence, and particularly the all of the numbers involved, not just with its size, but with its movements, its spin, its orbit, its position in space, its relative mass, its density, its size, all of it is done to this, like it's built like a Swiss clock. And no one can argue. The facts of the numbers are not cannot be debated. They are known. But no one's looked at them as we're looking at them until now. And when you line them all up, you're very unscientific if you say, oh, well, that's a coincidence, and that's a coincidence, and that's a coincidence. It cannot be so. You get to a point where you say, someone built it, or something built it.
The moon has been impacted. All you have to do is look at it through a telescope, and you can see the craters and the bombardment on portions of it. Why didn't these objects that struck the moon simply go right through the moon?
Well, the moon is quite solid. It may be very light in terms of its geological composition, but it's also quite dense. So it's quite obvious that anything that hits it is going to make a crater. It makes very strange craters. I mean, for example, we have very little real idea as to the volcanicity of the moon, as to whether the moon ever had a volcanic component. Some people say that the floors of those areas that we call the mares, if you like, or the seas of the moon, may well be the residue of lava that's flowed out from lower down when the moon was molten. We think that's probably less than likely. But material would not go straight through the moon because although it's very light in weight, it's also very dense. In fact, it's the best possible kind of material to absorb impacts, which is probably why whoever made the moon partly decided upon using surface material from the Earth. It's not as brittle as metal-bearing soils would, and rocks would be. So it's ideal for its purpose. And that's why it rings like a bell when it's struck.
When it was it manufactured with machinery? Or, I mean, there must have been something that they did to pull the material from the surface of the Earth and then create it for the moon. How did they did it?
If you take a series of very small black holes, now black holes are a strange phenomena. They're very small, but they have tremendous gravitational pull. Now, what we're suggesting is a possibility, and bearing in mind that the technology used to make the moon is probably slightly beyond us at this particular point in time.
I understand.
And you place these black holes in an orbit around an infant planet like the Earth, bearing in mind that the Earth is also in a fairly fluid state at that point in time, then the black holes will be sufficiently strong that they will literally overcome the gravity of the Earth itself and draw a stream of material into space across the whole of the Earth, most likely. Now, when that material achieves its orbit, when it's far enough away from the Earth that the Earth cannot influence it, then those black holes are turned down or off. And that material, by itself, given time, because of the specific laws of physics, will come together to form the moon. So you don't need machinery in the sense of diggers or people with shovels or anything mm-hmm. like that. Once you've drawn the material off the Earth, it will coalesce eventually.
And it was done with then knowledge far greater than we have right now. And as you say, though, we're getting to a point where we're beginning to understand black holes, maybe even how to create some of them. But this is technology that is 4 billion years old. So that means whoever did this, and we'll talk a little bit about that next hour, had a purpose, came here for this purpose, or did whatever they had to do technically in order to get it done. But they knew that in order for life then, you're saying, to sustain itself, to create itself on this planet, we needed to have a companion. Is that true?
That's true. And and whoever did it left the message to say they've done it.
Was it God?
That's one candidate for sure.
When you're at a conference or when you speak about this theory, I'm curious, what kind of reaction do you get?
It's really interesting. At first, whether it's a media interview on radio or whatever, or you're speaking to a rational, normal audience, the first thing is that you sort of get strange looks like, are these guys dangerous? You know, do we need men in white coats? But then slowly, as they hear the argument, the faces change. And the number of times at the end we've had, wow, that just changes everything. This is amazing. When you listen to the actual evidence in detail, you just can't argue with it. It's an explanation for that which we don't understand. Science likes to pretend it can understand things because it hates not understanding. But the moon just doesn't obey all the rules that we know it should do. Once you start looking at the new evidence that we've got, that is absolutely hard evidence, it's not debatable stuff, it suddenly all makes sense. And when people hear it, they become extremely excited and interested. The only bit that we, or say, bit, the part that we can't be sure about is who did it. That's, you know, open to debate. We've got our favorite theory, but it's for whatever people want to believe. But the actual argument about it being artificial is waterproof.
When our astronauts, United States astronauts, went on the moon in the 60s and 70s, did they uncover anything strange that maybe you've uncovered that we haven't been told?
It's very difficult to know exactly what the astronauts found because, of course, in terms of the stuff that they brought back, if there was anything that the authorities didn't want us to see, then we wouldn't have seen it. What they did to strengthen our theory is they brought back rocks. Now, it was thought at the time that the Apollo missions first went to the moon that we would very soon know exactly how the moon was made, what the moon was made of, and that the whole question with regard to the puzzle of the moon would be answered. But what actually happened was the exact reverse, and the number of questions left by what the astronauts brought back was even greater. For example, the age of the rocks on the moon. Nobody ever dreamed in their wildest dream that the rocks on the moon would be the same age as the rocks on the Earth, but that's what turned out to be the case. It's quite likely that the astronauts discovered nothing on the moon about which we don't know, but what they did discover is part of what gave Chris and I the incentive to do this research and ultimately to write this book, because the moon is so old.
I mean, one guy from the Apollo program said to me that when they first crashed an object into the moon to see what happened, when they got seismographs placed on the moon, they said it rang like a bell,
yeah,
and it was
vibration.
It was on gas struts. It wibble wobbled, as though it was taking the impact on some sort of gas struts, which wasn't meant to be a literal truth, but it wasn't going to be on gas struts. But it's so cleverly designed that it just soaks up impact, and there's nothing in the universe that behaves like that that's known elsewhere.
What about the eclipses that we hear so much about, the partials, the full? Is this unusual?
Absolutely.
I think it's extremely unusual in terms of totality. Let's look at another planet, for example. If we've got a very small planet with a very big moon like Pluto, for example, which is right out on the edge of the solar system, then what will happen when Pluto's moon passes across the face of the sun is that you will certainly get an eclipse, but it will cover the face of the sun from a line of sight view many, many times over. What's most unusual about our moon is that it has now achieved an orbit, because, let's face it, its orbit changes throughout time. It was much closer to the Earth at one time. But just at this particular time reference, it has an orbit which takes it 1/400th of the distance between the Earth and the sun, and the moon is 1/400th times the size of the sun. And because of that, the moon covers the sun absolutely accurately. And at times of total eclipse, all you can see of the sun is the corona, the matter that's coming off the edge of the sun. And in fact, scientists use that quite extensively to study the sun's composition. Without eclipses, that would have been very much more difficult, particularly in historical times. So total eclipse is very unusual indeed. There is another kind of eclipse when the moon is on a different part of its orbit, which is called an annular eclipse. And in that, it doesn't exactly cover the face of the sun. It's slightly smaller. But total eclipses, as far as we know, are unique. And they're certainly unique in our solar system and probably unique everywhere. The only reason that we accept the extremely peculiar nature of eclipses and total eclipses is because we see them. And so, therefore, we assume it's natural. What we are saying is it's part of a message which says, look, there's something very strange about this body.
And we'll chat a little bit more about this next hour, about who created this message. We'll get both of your info takes. Christopher Knight, Alan Butler, a little bit later on next hour, we'll be joined by our Coast to Coast Science Advisor, Richard C. Hoagland, who is... got a whole bunch of questions. I'm George Norrie, back in a moment. Welcome back to Coast, Christopher Knight, Alan Butler, our guest. I'm George Norrie. Gentlemen, when you looked at the relative size of the moon, compared it to the Earth, what was the first thing that popped up while you were doing this?
Well, the first thing that we noticed was the fact that this ancient unit of measurement we'd been looking at worked perfectly on the moon, which was sort of crazy. So we started looking at the moon in general. And the Earth rotates 366 times as it goes around the sun once. So you could sort of say the Earth's number is 366. And the moon rotates round one orbit around the Earth in 27.322 days. Now, the strange thing is that the moon is 27.322% of the Earth, and the Earth is 366% of the moon. So their own orbits are exactly the same as their relative sizes. Now, that struck us as crazy. And we already knew that, as Isaac Asimov said, that the eclipse is the most extraordinary coincidence in the universe, that the moon is 400 times smaller than the sun. And 400 times the distance. So we started to look at the numbers involved, and all of them just worked perfectly. In 366 lunar orbits, the Earth has exactly 10,000 days. The moon turns through 400 kilometers exactly in one day. It's exactly 1% of the speed of rotation of the Earth. All of the numbers just are perfect, and the same numbers keep popping up. It was very, very strange.
The evolution and the life on this planet, you believe, was basically safeguarded because of this moon. Explain how.
The basic building block of life is DNA, and it's an extremely complex substance, is DNA. In fact, the author Lyle Watson once said that he computed that there are more unlikelihood of DNA coming together in open space than the number of known atoms in the universe. Ergo, it couldn't really have happened, and yet we know that it did because we're here. Now, we make a suggestion in the book that it seems most likely that DNA was actually seeded on the Earth when the conditions were right for it to be put there, which would, to some extent, explain how DNA could be here. But I think the most important thing is to realise that, first of all, the Earth had to be right in order to be able to sustain life. Just one example of that from scientific research is that there was massive tides upon the Earth in the early days because the Moon was much closer to the Earth. And the constant coming and going of huge tides has been suggested as one of the mechanisms by which DNA was allowed to function and to grow in the way that it did. But the Moon allowed Earth life to develop also because of its physical properties and the effect it had on the Earth. For example, the fact that it kept a seasonal quality to the Earth. If it were not for the fact that the Earth maintained the orbit it does around the Sun, we would have very hot equators, a very cold polar regions, and nothing in between. We need a temperate world in order for life to be sustained, and that's in fact what has happened. There are many ways in which we can show that the Moon has, if you like, cherished and incubated life upon the Earth.
I mean, the essential ingredient is water. And there is nowhere in the known universe where water is at a liquid state, because in the temperature ranges that exist, from absolute zero to absolute huge temperatures where there's no upper limit, water is only liquid in this tiny, tiny sliver of temperature range, which happens on Earth. Most of Earth has got fluid water, which is what we need to produce intelligent life. Clearly, we're made of water, and without it, you just could not have higher life. So the Moon has kept the Earth at the correct angle to maintain this liquid that is life-giving. Without it, we would just be another frozen planet flying around the Sun pointlessly.
Well, they had some knowledge then that this Moon was critical to the planet. I wonder if whoever did it or whatever did it did this in other systems. What do you think?
They haven't done it in this solar system, but yes, maybe, possibly, some super force has gone around different galaxies and different solar systems doing similar things. We don't know. But we're now starting to see and understand other Earth-type situations in other areas of space, and we haven't seen anything like it elsewhere yet, but that's very early on.
It's also worth saying at this point in time that if some agency had done it elsewhere, each case would be different than the other, because what needs to be done first is to analyse the size and distance of the planet in question and the Sun, and then to make a Moon which not only does all the prerequisites in terms of sustaining life, but which would give intelligent creatures upon that planet a good indication of what's happened.
Let's paint a scenario, if you would. The Earth has formed or is forming. There is no Moon. Kind of tell us what's going on here in this solar system.
Well, what you've got is a situation like Venus, where the Earth was and the other planets were coalescing from debris, that soup that was sort of spinning around the Sun. All the planets were in the same plane. And Venus, for instance, collapsed in around itself and has almost like a shiny marble surface. So you've just got this great sort of ball bearing, this sort of like steel object. The Moon was like in its first phase, was like a plow. A farmer who wants to grow something and you've got a baked surface has to go out and break the surface, pulling their plow with their oxen or tractor in these days. And then you've got a chance of growing something. That's what the Moon was in its first stage. It was a plow to carve up the surface of the Earth. Without it, we would be dead, like the planet Venus.
Okay, and then explain, because we might as well get into it, what you think happened. I mean, why did whatever, spot this planet and make this decision?
That really very much depends upon which candidate you go for. At the end of this whole investigation and writing process, Chris and I have no doubt whatsoever that somebody or something made the moon. The only difficulty is establishing who that was, because the circumstances under which it was done would be different in each case.
You talked about three possibilities earlier. We might as well just outline them.
Okay. The first possibility that we came up with is, to many people, the most obvious, and it is one that some people who've read our book and have got in touch with us quite clearly cling to, and that is that it was done by God. At first sight, this seems extremely likely, and it's something that Chris and I discussed a great deal. Who would be in a better position to want to help humanity to develop than God? And if God was working within the known laws of physics, which he himself had created, then he would have to bring about some mechanism by which life could be incubated on the Earth. But this poses quite practical as well as ethical problems. For a start, the kind of God that we accept across most religions in the world is a God who exists by faith, not necessarily by proof. Of course, it would mean a great change in religion if we not only thought that God existed, but could see examples of his handwriting, as in the case of the moon. But we have another potential problem here. We know that the Earth and the Sun existed before the moon was created, because the moon has been created from the material and from the patterns of the Sun and the Earth. That being the case, the moon is definitely an afterthought. And we had to ask ourselves, is it likely that an omnipotent and omnipresent being such as God would need to tweak his own creation, as it were? That's the first possibility. God.
Okay. All right, next one.
Well, the next one was alien beings, advanced creatures from some other part of the universe that were so way ahead that they could travel these huge distances and had taken it upon themselves to spot likely planets for seeding life. And they, on their travels, saw the Earth and thought, yep, we can do a bit of work here, and they created the moon and went away again. But they left their calling card to say they'd done it. The problem with that is that the message that is designed is clearly designed to come to us today and clearly designed to come to human beings, ten-fingered creatures, because everything's in base 10. So they would have had to have known how we were going to develop. But there again, it's possible they were also responsible for the seeding of the DNA. So it's not an impossible theory. But it's interesting that, you know, scientists are increasingly talking about this sort of possibility as being real. I mean, Professor Anthony Flew, who's a lifetime atheist and doesn't believe in anything like that, in his 80s, had turned around last year and said a superintelligence is the only good explanation for origin of life on Earth. And so he believes that God has done it, but it could equally well be some well-meaning aliens. If somebody wants to believe it's God, fine. If somebody wants to believe it's aliens, fine. But we have a third theory, which we think is slightly more likely.
And this one, and then I want you to put them all on the table, and then we'll go back to the God one first, alien being second, and then this third one again. And I want to be able to review a little bit each one. But the third theory then, tell us how you came up with it, first and foremost.
Well, it seemed to us that the creatures who would have the best interest in creating the moon were the very same creatures who'd noticed what the moon was doing, and that is us. And although it sounds at first quite strange and difficult to get your head around, as we know from reactions we have from our readers, our third theory is that the people who created the moon was us. Nobody in the solar system, nobody in the universe has a better investment in life having developed on Earth than the very intelligent creatures who have come to rule the Earth, and that's humanity. So, again, you know, having to explain it very briefly makes it sound extremely odd. But what we're suggesting is this, that at some stage in the future, humanity takes on board what we are saying here, realizes that the moon is artificial, and also realizes that it will be our job to do it. Now, this involves time travel. There isn't a scientist in the world who can tell you that time travel doesn't exist, but I suppose your scientists will then go on to tell us that you can't prove a negative. But there are many quite influential physicists who positively do accept possibility of time travel. And what would be necessary, of course, would be for people or perhaps machines to go back in time and to the dawn of the solar system and to create the very moon that we see over our heads at the moment.
Now, this is an interesting theory because it's almost like a paradox. If they came back in time to build the moon, how did they get here in the first place?
The problem with the paradox is that, by definition, it can't be solved. It just means it's something that humans can't get their head around. But all scientists are agreed that the laws of physics and the laws of mathematics indicate that time travel is possible, and an increasing number of people say it is going to happen. And, in fact, it may be happening within the next 12 months. There are experiments being created to send subatomic particles backwards
sure.
in time. And there are people working on it to send larger objects backwards in time. There is absolutely no reason why it shouldn't exist. But yet people say, well, if we built the moon, so we'd be here, you've got a sort of circle. Yes, you have, but there's no problem with it. It may hurt your head to think about it, but scientifically, squeaky clean. So the only of the three alternatives, the only one that is scientifically squeaky, completely squeaky clean, is the time travel theory.
It is a strange theory, though. It really is.
It sounds strange, but it isn't.
Let's just have a look at this paradox just for a very brief moment.
Sure.
One of the main reasons why people suggest that time travel would be impossible is the famous paradox of a person who goes back in time and shoots their own grandfather. Now, mm-hmm. having done so, of course, your mother or your father would not be born, and if they were not born, then you would not exist in order to go back to shoot your grandfather. But you can turn that paradox completely on its head, and you can say, what happens if your grandfather is walking down the road and is about to be run down by a passing bus, and it is your absolute necessity and duty to go back in time and push him away from the bus? In other words, if you don't actually go back in time and do that, then your grandfather won't exist, and therefore you won't exist. So although the paradox sounds insoluble, it can be turned completely on its head. And if you extend that to our idea with regard to the moon, it could be suggested that the moon is there, the moon was made, somebody made it, we made it, therefore we have to go back in time to make it. And the only paradox develops if we don't.
What about dimensional travelers? Is that possible?
The whole idea about time travel creates all sorts of possible explanations, and one of these being that, yes, you can go back in time, yes, you could shoot your own grandfather, but what would happen immediately is that you would pass into a different dimension then. And there are physicists who believe that there are almost countless dimensions taking place at the same time. So everything on each dimensional Earth is just very slightly different, and one of those is the one where you have gone back and shot your grandfather. So in other words, what the suggestion is, you cannot create a paradox in your present dimension, but when you create the paradox, you pass into a different dimension. That's a possibility, and nobody can say that it isn't so, but we can't really understand, when we really look at all the evidence available, why it's impossible to affect your own environment in your own dimension.
Is our moon that different from other moons in the solar system?
Absolutely it is. Fundamentally different in terms of its size relative to its host planet, its makeup, its structure from high-density core outwards, into orbital characteristics. When we found this very clear mathematical patterning, we immediately looked at every other body in the solar system to see if this was something that happened elsewhere. It doesn't happen anywhere. It's just chaos, random numbers, which draws all the more attention to the Earth-Moon-Sun relationship. There is something fundamentally imperfect about it. We aren't number-picking. We're not picking the numbers that suit us. Everything about the moon is absolutely mathematically perfect within the metric system, and in terms of proportions and percentages. And every other body in the solar system is completely random.
We took our books when they first came out, and we sent them to a whole series of leading scientists and begged and pleaded with these people to get back to us and tell us where we had gone wrong. In other words, where were our numbers wrong? And the reaction has been absolutely nothing. And we feel sure that if somebody could take our book to pieces and say, look, you've invented this, or look, you've massaged this, or you've made this, that somebody would have done so by now. And the fact is that our numbers are sound. And if the numbers are sound, then the strangeness of the moon is sound, and we need some explanation.
The mathematics involved in your theory is very important, isn't it?
Everything that we have done is based upon those mathematics, and in particular, our observation that there is a relationship between the size ratio of the Earth, the Moon, and the Sun, and the orbital characteristics of the Moon around the Earth. We suggest that by the laws of chance, these should not exist. They're not only unusual, they're incredible.
Well, join us as well. He's got a few questions. You know Richard and his technical questions, so get ready for that. I'm George Norrie, and next hour we'll open up the phone lines, give you an opportunity to talk with Christopher Knight and Alan Butler right here on Coast to Coast AM. Well, if you've been following that Japanese asteroid mission, here's an update. The Japanese space probe thought to have landed on an asteroid last month may not have collected a surface sample after all, calling into question the success of the unprecedented mission to bring the extraterrestrial material back to Earth. Data from the Hayabusa probe, now hovering several miles from the asteroid, did not indicate that the vessel had fired a metal projectile into the asteroid's surface during its landing as previously thought. So they may not know, they say, until Hayabusa comes back to Earth in sometime 2007. We'll be back in a moment with our special guest, Christopher Knight, Alan Butler, who built the moon. Well, there's no question, Christopher Knight and Alan Butler, that the moon is certainly a very strange object in the corner of our system here. Why have you ruled out, though, the God, the divine intervention in terms of its possible creation?
We haven't ruled anything out. In the book, we say there are three possibilities. We've named our favorite of the three.
I see.
But
okay.
There's no way you can rule out the other two.
Are you waiting for someone to convince you of the other two?
Yes, we're welcoming a debate about this, and we've suggested at the end of the book that there has to be a major initiative to take stock of this, because it is a very clear, deliberate message directed at us at this point in time, and just to ignore it, it would be, well, criminal and crazy. I mean, there's a lot of people out there discussing, for instance, intelligent design, debating against the theory of evolution. Now, for us, the theory of evolution is as watertight as any theory gets. But the suggestion of intelligent design is also has a lot of merit to it. Scientists don't like the way that the debate is conducted, but it has its merits. So we would have thought that those people would be very interested in reviewing this information and joining in the debate as to whether this is a deliberate message from God, the entity that created the universe, and particularly created mankind as a privileged group. So we'd welcome debate and input from those people and from the church in general. We'd also welcome input from people that are working with SETI, for instance, that are looking for extraterrestrial life. The latest thinking for physicists is that we shouldn't be looking for incoming messages from aliens. We should be looking in our own backyard, as they put it. We should be expecting to see messages deliberately left a long time ago in our own backyard. They say that. Now, they should be looking at this to see is this evidence of aliens. And then people who, leading physicists who are saying they believe time travel is going to happen and happen soon, should be looking at this. If we are right about that third possibility, mm-hmm. there is a human need for us to get our act together, get our best brains working on it, and go back and build the moon. But, yes, we want to hear debate.
Tell me how you discovered the mathematical ratios of the relationship of the Earth, Sun, and Moon, and why they're so significant.
We, first of all, came upon this because we were studying ancient measuring systems, and particularly this one called the Megalithic Yard. The Megalithic Yard was discovered, rediscovered by a man called Alexander Thom, who was a professor of engineering at Oxford University, and he spent his life, his spare time anyway, and all his retirement time, measuring the ancient monuments left by the Megalithic peoples, places such as Stonehenge and Avebury, all the way from northern Scotland right down into France. And he came up with all sorts of conclusions, and one of them that he came to was that they'd used a uniform system of measurement, which was called the megalithic yard. This is about 82.966 centimetres in length, and it varied by only a tiny, tiny proportion across the whole of the monuments that he measured. Now, science has looked at this and said, well, how can this be so, that such a crude civilization could make such a uniform measurement? That aside, the statistical proof that comes from Alexander Thom's work shows that this indeed did happen. Now, we looked at the megalithic yard and we discovered, and show in our book Civilization One, that it was part of an integrated measuring system which encapsulated space and time and distance. And we started to look at the way that the megalithic yard fitted into the surface of the Earth. In a megalithic system, there are not 360 degrees in a circle, but rather 366. And they can be split, as our circle is, into minutes of arc and seconds of arc. And if you take one megalithic second of arc of the Earth, it measures 366 megalithic yards. Now, just for the sake of the exercise, we carried out the same experiment on the Moon and on the Sun, and we discovered on the Moon that same geometrical division results in exactly 100 megalithic yards, and on the Sun it comes out at exactly 40,000 megalithic yards. And we're talking about 99.99% fact here, so it's unlikely to be a coincidence. And once having looked at that, it drew our attention to the fact that the Moon was really rather peculiar. And when we started to study the ratio, size ratio, between the Earth, the Moon, and the Sun, and then look at the orbital characteristics of the Moon as they stand at the moment, that's when all these very, very strange and very similar numbers began to fall out of the system.
What I find to be fascinating, too, is all three of your potential theories, of which you believe the third one, the time traveler theory, but they all consist around some kind of intelligence. And that I find to be extremely acceptable.
There is no doubt about that. That is the one thing we will not move on. The fundamental, there's two options. It's either the biggest coincidence that has ever been heard of or could ever be conceived, or there is a message here from an intelligence, and you really would have to be extremely perverse to argue that this is some sort of bizarre coincidence, because there is one after another, after another, after another, after another, and they're all perfect. They're not marginal. There is no doubt there is a great intelligence behind this, and hence the name of the book, Who Built the Moon? The question is, who? The fact is, something did, and it's more than the moon. It's our whole species. It's our human condition that was created.
Coast to Coast science advisor and head of the EnterpriseMission.com, of course, Richard C. Hoagland, who makes his career looking at celestial objects. Richard, say hello to Christopher Knight and Alan Butler.
Good morning, gentlemen.
Good morning, Richard.
Good morning, Richard.
Chris and I haven't talked in a few years, but I'm certainly an admirer of his work with Robert. And welcome, Alan, to a very interesting half of a very intriguing writing team.
Thank you.
You have hit another one out of the solar system, Chris.
Good.
This is provocative. It's controversial,
yep.
And I've got to hand it to you. You have courage. I could have some quibbles, and I was, sending a couple emails to George to ask questions, and I guess he threw up his hands because they were too technical, so he wants me to come on and basically ask you myself.
I need 6 degrees to figure out what you were shooting me,
well,
Richard.
Well, not really. The thing I find so intriguing is that you and I have never talked about this, Chris.
No, we haven't.
Yet we've arrived at kind of the same place. As you may know, many years ago, 47 years ago, I was Cronkite science advisor to CBS during the Apollo missions, and so I've been following the results and the astronaut briefings and the NASA documents and the manuals and the moon rock results and the analysis. And when I got into what I'm doing now, which is running the Enterprise mission and looking at the solar system through different eyes, the idea that somebody might have been here before us and done interesting things, what really surprised the hell out of me is these same fingerprints you've been describing all evening showing up in the moon data.
Yeah.
And you're absolutely right. The numbers for the moon are absolutely bizarre. They are so bizarre that it's like the pink elephant in the room of mainstream science that nobody wants to talk about. Harold Urey, who is a very, you know, well-known guy, he was Carl Sagan's progenitor. He actually made Carl who Carl became. He was the guy who tried to get NASA to actually go to the moon initially to do science and figure out how the hell could the damn thing be there, because you're right. You know, a lot of people have said over the years, if it wasn't for the fact that it's there, it shouldn't be there. There was a very famous guy in celestial mechanics, and I think he was in Britain. I don't remember his name off the top of my head, but he was a celestial mechanics expert who basically figures the motions of celestial bodies using Newton's laws and Kepler's laws and all that. And he was the first to discover that the motions, George, of the moon around the Earth are so irregular on a fine measurement system that they really can't be predicted very well. They just, it looked to him, and this is going to sound interesting, he ultimately came to the conclusion before the space age that the only way to explain the motions of the moon around the Earth was if it was hollow.
Well, Richard, let me ask you, of the three theories they threw out, of course they believe the third one, God, alien beings, or time travelers, do you agree with any one of those three as a possibility?
Well, funny you should ask. When we did the conference in Wisconsin, the Godman ET conference, which is a nice segue into our DVD set, which is available for Christmas at an 800 number, that George
Richard.
Will gladly mention in a couple of minutes.
Richard.
we actually tackled this, and I brought up the very interesting thing that these gentlemen tonight have brought up, and that is that the moon appears to be evidence of intelligent design, but not God. And I agree, Chris and Alan, for the reasons you cite, that God wouldn't have to tinker with his creation after the fact. And the only difference that I really have with you is on the time scale of the tinkering. Earlier in the evening, you made rather firm assertions that you think the moon was made, built, created, simultaneous essentially with the Earth 4.5 billion years ago. And then when George gently asked you on what basis you felt that, you said it was the age of the moon rocks compared to the age of the oldest Earth rocks. Is that right?
That's right. Yeah.
Okay. Now we date, science dates these by what's called radio chronometric measurements.
Yeah.
Radioactive isotopes that decay, and you basically are measuring when the rock cooled and became a rock as opposed to a liquid lava, right?
Yeah.
So you're propounding your theory on the idea that the radiometric ages of the moon rocks, meaning when they cooled and became solid, are as old as most of the oldest Earth rocks, right?
Yeah, we're taking that from science because we're not qualified to argue on that. So if you were to tell us that that dating is questionable...
Oh, no. The dating is fairly good, but I think I found the interesting little potential flaw in your dating, which is not the flaw in your theory.
Well,
the
dating doesn't matter.
How and when it was done.
Right.
It depends on, was it done?
Yeah, absolutely.
Suppose we have a technology that isn't your mini black holes, which would liquefy the surface materials of the Earth, and so you would get lava, and then it would crystallize, which is how you get moon rocks that are as old as the Earth if it was done back then, right?
Yeah.
If you have another technology, like anti-gravity, where you can make mass or inertia go away, so you can lift the material without melting it, and then reassemble it wherever you want, a quarter million miles away, where the moon is, then you'd have material that's as old as the Earth, but you wouldn't be able to use the NASA dating to tell you when it was put in place as the moon.
Yeah, that makes sense.
Is there not some evidence, Richard, that there has been volcanism on the moon?
Say again?
Is there no evidence that there has been some volcanism on the moon, that there's been volcanic activity?
They haven't measured it. They thought they were going to measure it when they landed Apollo 17 up at Mare Serenitatis, and it turns out they were looking at breccias, impacts, just meteors bombarding the moon even there.
It seems to me instinctively that there's no doubt that if you cannot prove that the moon has had volcanism, then your theory is very sound, and then the moon could be almost any age.
Well, here's what I how old I think it is, and you can take this for what it's worth. I look when I started looking at this problem, which was like decades ago, very quietly, George. I haven't talked about this to anybody except a couple of my colleagues, and it's going to be in the sequel to Monument someday if I ever get around to finishing it. My thinking was, gentlemen, let's look at the most remarkable upheaval in the history of life on Earth. And we discussed this, George, a few weeks ago when we did the Intelligent Design show, which is the so-called Cambrian Explosion. About 600 million years ago, you go from little, simple, tiny guys, blue-green algae, dumb, stupid algae, to the most incredible explosion of all of the life we all know of on the Earth. All the species, all the families, all the genera, all the incredible complexity. In fact, there's less complexity now because of extinctions than there was back 600 million years ago when all these forms suddenly, out of nowhere, appeared.
After billions of years of nothing,
of nothing except the blue-green algae.
Yeah.
So, gentlemen, that's when I pegged the, quote, creation or the movement into the solar system of the moon. Because without the moon, in the physics model that I've been working on for 20 years, you don't have the physics to bring forth life. Your other points you made tonight about the need for the moon to create plate tectonics and all that, absolutely right on. That's why Venus is a dead twin and the Earth is a live twin. And the stability and keeping the polar axis aligned and all that stuff, yes. But the dating is the key part, and I would submit for your consideration, if you have a technology, a God-like technology, but not from God, I'm going to pick number two. I would vote for your super alien beings as opposed to humans going back in time. And these are all testable. At some point, if we get enough data from an honest set of space agencies, not just ours, we can test these theories.
And I pick one, Richard.
Say again?
I pick number one.
You pick one.
I think it was
two.
A godly creation.
Okay, well, then you have to explain why did God hiccup and wait? And why did he wait 3.5 billion years or 4 billion years to roughly 500 million years ago to rechange the garden?
Because he could.
But why?
That I don't know.
Well, that's a key question. That's part of the model. You've got to answer the question. Back to my point, we're running out of time here, I guess.
Yeah, 2 minutes.
I commend you for your work. I think you have to extend it. I think you have made an incredibly good beginning, but there's all kinds of juicy nuggets to be found in the details. And as astonishing as people seem to think it is, when you started the show by saying that all the mainstream theories are even wilder and weirder, you're absolutely right.
Richard C., again, you add a different perspective, and what's fascinating is here's basically three different people, those two as one, you and me, and we all agree on one separate issue of their three theories. That's weird.
That's great. That's the debate we want. We've started a process here, or one element of it, and Richard's right. There are a lot of people coming from different directions.
Well, there was Don Wilson who wrote
a big
the book called Our Spaceship Moon, which actually started my thinking in this direction.
Sure.
By the way, Richard, since you brought it up, can you get the Godman and E.T. videos out for people for Christmas if they're giving them away as gifts?
Absolutely, at 1-877-345-6222.
Or on the EnterpriseMission.com website.
Absolutely.
Correct? All right, good. Thanks, Richard. Thanks
for
your insight.
Thank you, gentlemen.
Appreciate
that. Thank you, Richard.
Always appreciate it. Yeah, you would not believe the technical things he was shooting my way. He had mathematics and ratios. I think he had a slide rule and a compass next to himself and everything else. But when we come back, gentlemen, at the top of the hour, we're going to open up the phone lines because we're going to let Coast to Coast listeners chat with you about these possibilities. And, of course, you heard it. Richard C. believes that alien intervention created the moon. Christopher Knight and Alan Butler believe that it was done by earthly time travelers. And I believe it was God, quite frankly, that the moon has a purpose, no doubt about it. And those are our different thoughts. What about yours? We'll be back with you in a moment on Coast to Coast AM. And welcome back to Coast. I'm George Norrie. Christopher Knight, Alan Butler, our guests, your phone calls. Christopher and Alan, regardless of the three potential theories that you bring forward for us, there is no doubt that without the moon, there would be no us. Is that correct?
That's absolutely correct. No one argues that point.
And the fact that this has then occurred can't be luck. And as you say, I don't believe in coincidences, and it sounds like either do you in this case, huh?
There are limits, you know. We really didn't want to get to the point we're at. We tried hard to rationalize it all away, but eventually you've just got to say there's something strange here and something very, very big going on.
Okay, let's go to our callers. They're lining up, and this hour will go by very quickly. East of the Rockies, welcome to Coast. You're on the air with us. Hi there.
Hi, George. How you doing? This is Robert from Northwest Arkansas.
Hi, Robert. Thanks for calling in. It's all yours.
Long-time listener, first-time caller. I got my own theory, actually, on how the moon was formed, and forgive me for saying this, but I, too, believe that that God created the heavens and the earth. And at the beginning of the solar system, when the earth was first formed, I believe it was molten, and it was lob-shaped. It was spinning out of control. It was, you know, elongated, and part of the elongation dripped off, and that's what formed the moon. And I'd like to get your guest's opinion on that theory.
Okay, who wants that? Christopher, Alan, which one?
I've got that one. it's quite a popular theory, this, although it's, to a certain extent, scientists, not us, but scientists, have discredited this theory, and it's all because of computer projections. If you make a model of this particular situation, the rate at which the Earth has to be spinning in order to throw off this tear-shaped piece that becomes the moon becomes untenable in terms of what we know the Earth is doing now. Now, neither I nor Chris are in a position to repudiate what you're saying. It sounds a reasonable theory to me, but scientists tell us that when it comes to computer modeling, that particular theory doesn't work.
Okay, and how about you, Christopher?
We are not scientists. We have used the work of scientists in this book and quoted them, and we've added our own observations that have come by our own research into ancient measurement systems. So we can only quote what scientists say, and I don't know why Robert has chosen to believe what he believes, unless it's just sort of something he's dreamt up, or whether he's got a scientific argument behind it, but it isn't said to be possible.
For life to exist like ours on other planets and other systems, must they also then have a moon with the same kind of mathematics, the same proximity to the planet?
I think a
lot would depend on whether or not the planet itself had the right kind of attitude with regard to its sun, whether it could achieve temperate zones in which life could develop. There are all sorts of possibilities, but it does seem fairly unlikely to me that without some substantive body like the moon, a very reactive planet, which is the kind of planet upon which life will develop, could possibly have the kind of staying power to allow that kind of thing to develop without, for example, toppling over. So whilst we can't say for certain that the answer to that question is yes, it has to have a moon, it does seem very likely.
You know, there are many people who believe that we are alone in this entire universe. Do you believe in life elsewhere?
That's a question of sort of faith, which personally I don't like faith. I like to make judgments on at least, you know, rational information. So it's an impossible question to truthfully answer, but my gut feeling is we probably are alone.
And how about you, Alan?
I tend to differ a bit from Chris in that I do tend to think that there's probably life all over the universe. But having said that, it's almost like believing in God. It's a matter of faith, and I freely admit it's a matter of faith, because there is no substantial proof that there is life anywhere else. And if there is no positive to be proven, you therefore have to accept a negative, in which case I've got to defer to Chris, really, although my instinct, my gut tells me there probably is life elsewhere.
All right, let's go west of the Rockies. You're on Coast to Coast. Hi there.
Hello.
Yeah, go ahead there.
Hi. Well, I'm going to agree with theory number one, so I'm going to agree with you.
God created the moon.
And the man that earlier was on, he had an issue with that theory, the billion years, or he was like, why did he wait a billion years? And I was wondering if any of you are familiar with Mormon theology?
A little?
Okay. Well, one of the theories is that, our belief is that, God just didn't create one earth. And then he's constantly creating the universe, and there's other worlds with people on them. And that would kind of maybe explain that, you know, maybe he's just a really busy man.
Yeah, he
that
really
sounds
is.
Really silly, but but also, I would also agree that it would have to be the most incredible accident for the moon to just have...
Just happened to be there at the right spot.
Exactly. And so,
sorry, one of the reasons why we put forward three possible scenarios in our book was because we couldn't be absolutely certain in our own minds which of the theories was correct. We tend to, both of us, go for the third theory because we think it answers the majority of questions. But it seems apparent from the reaction that we're getting from people, both through the kickback we get from the book and through radio and television, that many people do accept the theory that God could have done this. Now, we can't say for sure that that wasn't the case, and our tendency to accept the third theory is really down to our own an analysing of the situation, but many people already who have read this book do believe that God was responsible.
And let's talk about your theory again, because I'm having a difficult time understanding how it works. Time travelers, you say, created the moon. So people from the future, how many, who knows, but how many years in advance? Thousands of years in advance?
We could be talking about hundreds.
Hundreds.
We could be talking about tens.
All right.
The rate of, if you look at the rate of growth that's happened since, say, 1950, the last half century, in our ability with computer technology to reach the moon and to do all sorts of things, and you extend that, and the fact that we're now looking, you know, within the next year or so at experiments to go back in time, you know, early experiments. I mean, the Wright brothers were, it's only 100 years, just over 100 years since the Wright brothers at Kitty Hawk there were skimming across the surface of the sand, and now, you know, we've been landing on the moon ages for decades. So that if we look at that, sort of rate of progress, we could be talking about tens of years even. Who knows? If the world wakes up to the fact that this needs looking at, I mean, the great thing about Richard Hoagland coming along there is he's adding to it, and he's discussing it and thinking around it, and we've got your callers coming in. That's what we need. We need
sure.
to discuss this and to push it and see where it goes.
Well, if the time travelers from the future went back into the past and created the moon through the use of wormholes and other kinds of things that were apparent to them, that means there was no moon in the first place.
Correct.
Which means they should not have existed in order to come back to make a moon.
Well, you're repeating the paradox of time travel. That's nothing to do with our theory. That's the basic paradox of time travel. But all scientists have agreed that they could overcome that. So your argument there is not with us or the theory we've put forward. It's with mainstream science.
The fact you also, can't understand George, it isn't think about problem, the reverse paradox
what I mean.
Theory of the man who goes back in time and saves his grandfather from being run over by
yeah.
a bus. It could well be that there are some events in time which simply have to be interfered with, and creating the moon could be one of them. And you have a paradox if you don't do it.
Why did you select the time traveler theory as opposed to extraterrestrial alien intervention?
We haven't. All three theories are there.
But I mean, you favor the
yeah,
time
we do
travel.
Favor it, and the reason is that it is 100%. It fits what science knows 100%. It doesn't assume anything. As far as we know, testably and provably, there is nothing else in the universe that's intelligent besides human beings. So to embrace the second theory, we would have to make an assumption. For the first theory would also have to make an assumption, because God of faith would suddenly be turning into a God of fact, which would be a major step. For the third theory, we don't have to make any assumptions. It's all 100% squeaky clean, acceptable science. That's why we went with it.
If I could just put one other point in as well, George.
Sure, Alan, go ahead.
The fact is that whoever created the moon knew that at some particular finite point in time, there would be an intelligent species on the Earth who could look up and who could see the moon for what it is and who could take the approach that we've taken and work out that the moon is artificial. And the messages that are in the moon, we believe, have been deliberately left in order to facilitate that. And now, of the three theories, the most likely theory, therefore, must be that we did it, because if we take the second theory, for example, the aliens, they would have had to have stuck around for 4.5 billion years in order to know that a species like us would be likely to exist, and then they would have to have gone back in time to create the moon. It creates all sorts of unnecessary frills and fancies as against the very plain and simple theory that the people who have the most to gain by it and who know that we will look up and see the message in the moon are the people who did it.
Let's go to our West of the Rockies line. You're on Coast to Coast. It's your turn. Hi there.
Hello, gentlemen. This is Eric. I'm in Phoenix, Arizona.
Take it away, Eric.
I got to tell you, this is one of the best shows I've heard. I've been listening for coming up on 10 years now, and I love this kind of stuff. I have a theory and a question.
Okay.
The theory about why crime goes up when there's a full moon is that the criminals can see better.
That could be.
Could be. My question is this, and I know you guys aren't scientists, and neither am I, but everything that I know of in space that orbits around something else has a decaying orbit, which means it's always getting closer to the object that it's orbiting. So how then can the moon be doing the opposite and getting farther away?
This is very interesting, and it has to do with the fact that the moon has its own angular momentum. If you throw, if you have a weight on a piece of string and you wave it around your head, of course the weight tries to get away, the string lengthens, and it can't go any further because of the length of the string, and you reach a break-even point. Now, the same is true with the Earth and the moon, but the string is not quite extended yet. So, in other words, there was force and momentum when the moon was created, which threw the moon outwards. The moon will eventually reach a situation of stasis in which the Earth and the moon have a common orbit, and then undoubtedly, given time, the situation will reverse itself. But for the moment, the moon is still traveling outwards.
Okay, that makes sense. And what about the Earth getting close to the sun? That's not going to be reversible, right? Eventually it's going to impact.
Yes, there's no doubt about that. But before that happens, the sun will turn into a supergiant and will swallow the Earth in any case. So we don't need to worry about us contacting the sun. It will be seeing us first.
So essentially we're damned anyway.
whatever happens, yes. But
unfortunately,
it's a very, very, very long way off.
All right, great. Thanks, Eric, for your phone call. First-time caller line, you're up on Coast to Coast. Hi there.
Hello, I'm Scott calling from Atlanta. How are you tonight?
Fine, Scott. Thank you.
Just wanted to throw something out there for you. A minute ago, you were asked why that you chose to believe in the first theory. And I wanted to throw something out. In the book of Genesis, it does not ever state the time frame of the Creator creating water, but yet His Spirit hovered over the face of it. He does go through a time frame of creating of land and the animals and et cetera. And I was wondering what your thought was to that, as to possibly being the answer of why he had a time frame, a time gap, in between the actual creation of the earth and then the recreation of the moon following the creation of the Garden of Eden.
The time gap. I don't know. Can either one of you answer that?
Well, it's a bit complicated when you look at the myth, the scriptures, the ritual of different religions. I mean, the book of Genesis is fantastically interesting. I'm hugely interested in documents like that. But you have to know that there are many versions, and the sequence and timescales vary dramatically, whichever version you choose to believe. The Old Testament, as it's read today, is not exactly what you call authentic. So it varies greatly. But we did notice that there are certainly similarities in the thrust of one of the earliest versions of the Book of Genesis is what we're reading. So there was a time when we were strongly supporting the God theory, but neither of us are practicing people of any religion. But we were very close to backing that one at one point. So the Book of Genesis is, you know, we quote it, you know, in the book. It is interesting.
There's also another factor here. If we assume that God made the earth, then we can assume also that God set in motion the laws of physics. Now, it is upon the laws of physics that things like the existence of water are based. And so if one was to take the line that God did indeed specifically create the earth, then it's quite likely that the building blocks that he needed were already there because he'd created the laws of physics. In other words, he created physics, went away for his breakfast, and then came back and started molding with what he'd already made.
On a point scale, did you two pick number three, time travelers, overwhelmingly, or was it close to the other two?
We discussed and discussed for a long time, but ultimately we had to use what what they call Occam's razor, and that is you don't invent complex theories when there's a simple solution. So we went for the simplest solution. We've no vested interest in which one it is. All we're certain of is the moon was created not by natural forces, but by a deliberate intelligence. So we debated long and hard, and having come to the our preferred theory, we're quite comfortable with that. But it was touch and go all the way through, and we're there to be persuaded. We're not wedded to it. It's not we're not pushing that.
So you can be swayed.
Absolutely. That the reaction that we're getting from the book, to be absolutely fair and honest with you, the majority of people who make a comment on the three theories, the vast majority do not accept our theory. And as Chris says, we are willing to be swayed by argument. We tried to be very scientific and rational all the way through the book, and we tried to avoid allowing our own prejudices to get in the way. I think Chris has just admitted, and I agree, that we did talk long and hard, particularly about the God theory, before we finally settled on the third. But we're open to argument.
Do most people pick the God theory?
On balance, I would say, from what I have on my computer now, from the reactions we've had, probably yes.
I think that's reasonable because that's the whole history of our society, that most people at one level, or whether they're practicing Christians, Jews, Muslims or whatever, believe in a maker. So it's reasonable to sort of slot this sort of information into their existing belief system. So we would expect that to happen. And, of course, it may well be true.
All right, well, stay with us. We've got a final half hour to go. The rest of your phone calls with our guests Christopher Knight and Alan Butler. Their book is called Who Built the Moon? I'm George Norrie, back in a moment on Coast to Coast AM. Back to the phones we go with our guests Christopher Knight and Alan Butler, our final segment on Coast to Coast. Hi there, East of the Rockies. How are you?
I'm doing pretty well. I'd really like, my name is Zach, I'm from Amarillo, Texas, and I'd like to thank you for taking my call. I've actually been in my car for more than an hour because my radio's broken inside. I love the show, and this is really fascinating. This is something that I've been mulling over for a while, and it never occurred to me, the moon. And so what I'd like to ask is, one of my fascinations is, and I guess I should say for the record, I believe in the first part, I'm a creationist. But my fascination has always been with the idea of terraforming, of making a lifeless planet like Earth. And what I wanted to ask was, have you thought about, similar to your second scenario of extraterrestrials, have you thought about colonization, that perhaps mankind originated on another planet somewhere else and has set us up on this planet? I was wondering if you had any thoughts on that, I wanted to ask also,
sure.
I'd really like to know if you have a website, email, any way I could correspond, because I've got some questions and some points, but there's no time on the radio show, and I was wondering if there's any way you might be able to correspond.
Christopher Allen, do you have those capabilities?
First of all, the website. We don't specifically have a website for Who Built the Moon, but if your correspondent goes to civilization1.com, he can post his questions there, and we'll get them just the same. So that's civilization1.com.
Civilization1.com. Okay, and then his question about colonization.
I think initially the feeling about that is that one cannot rule out anything, and it's the kind of area that's interested me for most of my adult life personally, and I think Chris has looked at these things as well. The only thing I'd say that probably might point against it is we are quite clearly, from a chemical composition and with regard to our development, creatures of the Earth. We don't seem to have been superimposed onto a system that we don't agree with in any way. There are certain difficulties to explain about human development, and these can be answered either by evolution or by, as your correspondent suggests, by creation. But I can't personally see anything that indicates that we developed elsewhere, but this theory cannot be ruled out.
Can I make a comment there?
Absolutely, Chris.
Yeah. It far from can't be ruled out. It is quite possible, because in the book we go beyond to say this message in the moon appears to be pointing us towards a big, big message. And we then pick up on various leading scientists who are seriously saying that there appears to be huge amounts of information hidden inside our own DNA. That's all life on Earth, not just human beings. Because there's certain parts of the DNA chain which we call junk DNA, which were assumed to be totally unimportant, but they haven't changed for hundreds of millions of years. Since the beginning of life on Earth, these little parts in the DNA have been protected, and they hold huge amounts of information. Typically, one part will hold a million bits of information, and then strangely, a million is a number that comes from the moon. If we start to use the information that's on the moon, it could be, and scientists are saying, if someone's going to contact us, it's going to be very, very big or very, very small. So if we go from the very big, the moon, to the very small inside our DNA, you could have Encyclopedia Britannica contained in there. And we've suggested in the book that whoever seeded this life on Earth, and that we're quoting serious scientists saying this, not our idea, that the message in there may well tell us who it is that wants us to know, whether that be God, whether it be aliens seeding it, or whether it be ourselves, with instructions of how to build a time machine. It appears that the actual message in the moon is pointing us to a bigger message that's right literally inside ourselves.
Okay, next up, west of the Rockies, you're up on Coast to Coast. Hi there.
Hi, this is Alex calling from Las Vegas.
Hello, Alex. Go ahead, sir.
My question is, and I apologize if you covered this earlier tonight, I'm just catching the tail end of the show, but my understanding about the moon is that it sort of helps stabilize the Earth's, like the poles are going crazy without the moon, it sort of stabilizes everything. Without it, we wouldn't be able to live on this planet. So my question is, wouldn't it be logical that if the moon is getting a little farther and farther away from us, that might have something to do with our weather being the way it is and getting crazier every year?
I think that's ostensibly a very valid point. But as far as I'm aware, there is no indication at this moment in time that there is much difference in terms of the way the world is behaving. But again, it's a situation that can't be ruled out. As to the first point, there is no doubt whatsoever that were the moon not where it is, the world would literally keep toppling over, and the prognosis for life under those circumstances is terrible.
Okay, thanks a lot, George, and thanks for the show.
Alex, appreciate it. Next up, Wildcard Line. Thanks for holding. You're on Coast to Coast. Hi there.
George, how you doing?
Good, sir. Thank you.
It's George in Rodney, Indiana. I was just wondering, there's a growing belief that we never did go to the moon, and if their basic tenets of their theory is that it was earthbound material, how big a hole would it blow in their theory? That, you know, because they would have had to supply Earth rocks for the scientific community to experiment with. And it may be the reason that it shows the earthbound materials. Have they taken that into consideration?
We have taken that into consideration. We discussed that in the book. We did go to the moon. The evidence is completely overwhelming, and the arguments that they were faked in some way are just don't stand up at all. But even if we hadn't been to the moon, it wouldn't greatly affect what we're saying at all. It wouldn't affect it hardly at all. But we are absolutely certain that NASA did do exactly what it said with the Apollo missions.
Another interesting point here from another very valid question. If we didn't go to the moon, then the chances of us producing rock of the kind that they brought back to the moon is very low, because the moon rock posed all sorts of problems and potential difficulties to science that didn't exist in earlier theories as to how the moon was made. It's quite likely that if people were going to choose rocks from a moon that they hadn't been to, bearing in mind the theories that existed at the time, they would have gone for much newer Earth rocks than the ones which were found on the moon. So this appears to be additional evidence that we, in fact, did go there.
Okay, let's go to our first-time caller line. Your turn. You're on Coast to Coast. Hi there.
Hi. This is Allison from Arlington, Texas.
Mm-hmm.
I was wondering, if we indeed did travel back in time and create our own moon and put it into orbit, then why would we not create a moon for our twin planet Venus and create a livable habitat?
That's very interesting.
I think when we talk about that possibility, we have to say, in order to create a moon to substantiate life on a planet like Earth, you need to have certain prerequisites in place. One of these would be the absolute distance of the planet in question from the sun. Now, the Venus, although it is very Earth-like in lots of respects, is very much closer to the sun than we are. Now, that may, for all I know, provide difficulties even if you have got a moon. We know that the surface of Venus is regularly changing. And when I say regularly, I'm talking on a timescale of millions of years rather than tens or hundreds of years. And we know that it's very much more solid than the Earth, probably at least partly because it hasn't got a moon. But what we don't know is what the internal structure of Venus is like. It may well be that it wasn't a very good candidate in the first place, and that might be part of the answer to your question.
Might have been a little too close to the sun.
I think that's possible, and I think that even with a moon, you would have had circumstances under which it would have been very difficult for liquid water to survive, and as far as we know, without liquid water, no life would be possible.
Wildcard line, you're up on Coast to Coast with Christopher Knight and Alan Butler. Hi there.
Hey, this is Lyle from San Diego. How you guys doing?
Good, Lyle. Thanks.
Hey, you covered my point earlier, but I think I can assure you that it's number two, because when summer of 73, I was 9 years old, I was taken on a tour of the universe and shown sights akin to the Hubble Space Telescope pictures.
Hold on. And who took you? Who took you, Lyle?
I don't know who it was, but it was a male, and apparently, from what I've thought over the decades, is that we are on a forced rehabilitation planet where we are the specific gravities and circumstances of this planet allows us to retune ourselves to rejoin the rest of the entities that we are outside of our physical bodies.
Were you taken in a craft?
No, no, just, he said, to hold onto my arm, and we zoomed off. No,
off
no feeling of motion, nothing.
Huh.
It was very, very bizarre. I could do a whole show on it.
You sure wasn't a dream, Lyle?
Oh, no, no. I woke up at about 1, I popped out of bed at 1 o'clock in the afternoon. I ran screaming 3 blocks from where my mom worked at the Navy PX in Illinois, and in my pajamas, almost got ran over by a car, screaming to my mom that, oh my god, I was taking all the, you know, and then but they're like, get away, kid, I'm trying to work.
That, well, let me tell you, that may be a whole show all by itself. I don't know. East of the Rockies, you're up on Coast to Coast. Hi there.
Hi, my name is Josh. I'm living in central Wisconsin.
Hi, Josh.
Hi, I have some issues about the mathematics. If the moon is on an orbit which is increasing with time, the mathematics that you are talking about, say, on in a total eclipse, would only be relevant for a certain time period.
Correct.
So the mathematics aren't that intriguing entirely, except for maybe right now.
That is the point we make in the book. It is a message directed at us right now, not a million years ago or a million years in the future. This is timed for us now.
What do you think the message is?
The message that we've picked up is that is clearly there is, pay attention to this, understand this, I'm talking to you. So we've only got the introduction, if you like. Clearly, there is a next phase of information, and it is aimed at human beings or ten-fingered creatures for sure at this particular point in time. You're quite right. It can't have been in the great past or in the great future. It is now.
All right, thank you.
Well said,
and another point just along those lines.
Sure.
It's self-evident that if this message had created itself, say, 10 million years ago, there would have been nobody to see it because of the creatures that were living on the Earth at that time presumably were not looking up at the sky. On the other hand, if the message did not appear for millions of years into the future, then we wouldn't have the scientific sense of mystery that we've had over the last 200 or 300 years. It appears that just at the time that we woke up from an intellectual viewpoint is when the message appears, and that's part of what we are saying in the book.
Okay, west of the Rockies, you're up on Coast to Coast. Hi there.
How you doing? This is Todd from Maui.
Hi, Todd. Go ahead, sir.
I'm covering this evening. It's actually bugged me for quite a few years. The relative size of the moon to the Earth. Now, I had read, I think it was in Zachariah Sitchin's book, that there was a event whereby another celestial body hit Earth way back in its prehistory, took off what we now know as the Pacific Ocean, which if I believe it's thinner there than it is, the crust is thinner there than it is anywhere else on the planet. And I'm wondering, I used to think that it was the celestial object hitting it, but then now with what they're saying today is realizing that there's a little bit too much stuff in the asteroid belt, really, to take up that much. It doesn't match. Is there a way to test, or has anybody tested for correlations between the Earth's crust material in the Pacific Ocean and that what they found on the moon?
Yes, I believe they have, and there is a direct correlation.
Excellent.
All right, there you go, Todd. Is it?
Thank you very much.
That's what you needed. You know, Zechariah Sitchin did some work of the old Sumerian texts, and they talk about a collision that the Earth had with another object, which I find fascinating that Sumerians 5,000, 6,000, 7,000 years ago would have a theory similar to what some scientists believe happened to the moon.
Absolutely.
Yes, absolutely. We've come across this many times in our own research. It's a great puzzle because, first and foremost, one would think that the Sumerians were not in a position to really understand even what a planet was. Quite clearly, we showed in our book Civilization One that knowledge that very early civilizations had was a lot greater than we give them credit for.
I mean, the Sumerians invented the metric system 2,500 years before the French thought they'd invented it, and that, you know, that's a matter of now of archaeological record. So they knew a lot from somewhere, those people.
Next up, east of the Rockies, you're up on Coast to Coast. Hi there.
Good morning, George. This is Debbie in Lebanon, Tennessee.
Hi, Debbie. Go ahead.
Hi. I agree with you that I think God made everything. And the question I have, or the thought I have, is it says that God made the earth and the heavens in 6 days. All right, how long is a day to God?
Couldn't it be
10 billion years? So maybe he made the earth in the morning and the moon in the afternoon, and that would correlate the difference in the ages of them?
Very, very possible. You two want to react to that?
That's been said before, and that could be entirely accurate. What is a day? It's defined mostly by the rising of the sun on Earth, but the spinning of the Earth is slightly different. But clearly, when God was setting about creating the Earth, there was no such thing as a day. So it must have been something different to that which we take today.
As an example, Hindus, for example, believe that one breath of Brahma, one breath of God, lasts several thousand years. So your correspondent could be quite correct.
So what's one of the first things you would ask a time traveler if you ever ran into one, Christopher?
Well, I believe they're there, so I wouldn't be entirely surprised if I ran into one. But I suspect it's going to be a lot easier to travel huge distances back rather than small distances back, if you see what I mean. It's probably easy to go back billions of years. than it is to go back 10 years, I suspect. So the chances of me ever meeting a time traveler are pretty slim, I think.
How about you, Alan?
Well, on balance, I think, without wishing to sound in any way flippant, I would like to go back to the Grassy Knoll and see who was actually standing there on that day.
Yes, I think I would. That's one of the things I'd like to do as well, quite honestly. Which is interesting, though. If you believe in time travel, is there any reason to doubt that it's possible that some time travelers could be here now?
I personally think, and this is nothing to do with the book, this is only my own personal gut reaction again, that they're probably here all the time, and I think that that might be one of the explanations for UFOs.
I think you both may be right. Well, good work. The book, Who Built the Moon, available where, gentlemen?
It's available on both Amazons. It's available at your local bookstore. If they haven't got it in, ask them to order it, and if not, you can get it on Amazon within a day or so.
All right, Alan, thank you. Christopher, thank you as well. Nice to have you back again.
Pleasure.
Thank you.
Fascinating subject. For Steve Carr, Dan Galanti, Tom Danheiser, Lisa Lyon, Lex Lonehood, Sean Latasur, Ian Punnett, and Art Bell, I'm George Norris. Somewhere out there on Coast to Coast AM. I'll see you on our next edition, originating back in Los Angeles, weather permitting, if I can get out of St. Louis. Until then, be safe, everyone.